thank you, thank you. Hello again. This is Jack Benny talking.
That's me, Groucho Marx.
The big story.
It's Jubilee!
Way back home.
The Armed Forces Radio Service is on the air. Yes, hour after hour, day after day, the Armed Forces Radio Service is on the air in round-the-clock operations. You'll hear many familiar voices during the next half hour as we present a special broadcast dedicated to this organization, which plays such an important part in the lives of American servicemen and their families stationed in every part of the globe. This is the AFRS story. To tell it, we must start at the beginning. And to start at the beginning, we must have silence. The mute silence of a network not yet born. No giant transmitters with their steel ribs rising into the sky. No waves of sound carrying mirth and music to the four corners of the earth. Our stars cannot talk to you. Our music, drama, news, sports events cannot reach your ears, for there are no facilities to send them hurtling through space. The year is 1942. The war is only a few months old, and it is being fought in remote, faraway places. You're a long way from home now. And into the silence come the awful sounds of battle. Then, when you have a brief moment to rest, the silence is broken again by music and a voice.
This is Tokyo Rose again, fellas, playing for me and my gal, just for you and your gal. By the way, I bet you're lonesome, aren't you? Do you suppose she'll wait for you? It'd be a shame to lose both the war and your girl. Remember when she told you she'd be waiting for you always? But always is a long time, fellas. A very long time.
Yes, during those first few months of the war, the only radio entertainment available to servicemen came through the courtesy of Radio Tokyo and Radio Berlin. Axis Sally and Tokyo Rose were getting in their little licks. It would have been understandable if such matters as radio broadcasting to the troops had been buried under large piles of more urgent matters in our nation's capital, but this was not the case. There was an ever-growing concern that factual information and news be reported regularly to the men in overseas areas. There was the obvious necessity for good entertainment through radio in the interest of morale. This was the beginning of the Armed Forces Radio Service. Its mission was clearly stated.
To provide radio and sound equipment, services and personnel for the information, education, and entertainment of armed forces overseas.
Very clear, concise, very simply stated. Easy enough to put on paper. But the translation of those words into fact was a tremendous job. What did it take to put it in operation? To break the silence and put AFRS on the air. Listen.
Equipment for the largest radio network in the world. Everything from tubes to transmitters, installed in 179 separate locations around the globe.
The immediate cooperation of the nation's vast commercial radio industry.
Establishment of operational headquarters in Hollywood, California, and gathering top-level writers, directors, performers, and executives.
Facilities for transcribing and shipping some 10,000 records a week to stations in Alaska, Africa, the South Pacific, the Caribbean, the Canal Zone.
In a remarkably few months, the work was done. Transmitters were constructed and manned. Mobile radio stations arrived in areas where the tide of battle was constantly moving. The talented members of the entertainment world joined forces with the technical staff that made up AFRS, and the magic of radio brought the sounds of home to men who were far from home.
And here he is, Bob Hope!
Fellas, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Well, here I am at Point Magoo on the coast of California. Very lucky you're still here. We've met at the Naval Missile Center. Of course, everything down here is scientific and automatic, and you can tell the Navy runs it. It's all buttons. everything here is so secret. In fact, before they let me do the broadcast, I had to swear no one was listening. I may be right. Point Magoo is like something out of a science fiction story. Last week, the CO put a notice up on the bulletin board. From now on, the moon is off limits. Really, this place is so advanced scientifically, they refer to Buck Rogers as that nice old gentleman. It's very hard to get into Point Magoo, but I didn't have any trouble. When I arrived, the guard at the front gate called an officer and said, "Sir, we found that missile we thought we'd lost." But they really take security seriously here at Magoo. This afternoon, I saw a dog chasing a cat, and they were both blindfolded. And to keep things really secret, the whole place is usually covered with fog. Oh, no! Here's a very lovely melody, a very lovely lyric, and a lovelier gal to sing it, Miss Betsy Delcher.
I thought I heard a radio over there. Where'd you guys get it?
Supplies putting him on.
No kidding.
Sure, they got a mobile station at Anzio already, just so as we wouldn't miss Bob Hope.
Is he here, too?
Nope, but they say he's coming over.
Well, next to seeing him in person, it's sure good to hear an American radio program again. Hey, I wonder if you can get Extra Sally on that thing.
Who cares? Nobody listens to her anymore. We got G.I. Jill.
Yes, they had G.I. Jill and her all-time jukebox review. They had Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Fibber McGee and Molly, Edgar Bergen. They had dozens of wonderful shows that brought music, fun, and laughter. Familiar segments of home. They had their own shows to fill their own requests. Shows like Melody Roundup for Western music, Mail Call, Jubilee, Hymns from Home. And they heard the voices of familiar stars who were appearing just for them.
Concert Hall, presenting as soloist, the well-known concert violinist, Joseph Zaghetti, and the Brazilian soprano, Biduce Al. And here to introduce your guest is your Concert Hall host, Lionel Barrymore.
Thank you, and welcome to Concert Hall. We reach into Europe and South America for our guest today, and present first the brilliant Hungarian violinist, Joseph Zaghetti.
For those who like their music in a lighter vein, there was the popular show called Remember.
Fellas, this is Bob Young, still substituting for Fred McMurray after 246 programs of Remember. You see, it was this way. One day Fred called and said, Bob, old boy. I knew right then there was something afoot. Bob, old boy, he said, would you mind doing a couple of programs for me? I just want to go out for a cup of coffee. I said I would, and he said good, and then left me here at this mic. That was 40 weeks ago. I know you can grow old trying to get waited on around here, but 40 weeks? Hey, he must have wanted...
And then there was the biggest show of them all.
Command Performance, USA. The greatest entertainers in America is requested by you, the men and women in the United States Armed Forces throughout the world. Command Performance, presented this week and every week till it's over there.
Yes, Command Performance, a star-studded show that couldn't have been duplicated at any price. That was the show where servicemen asked for and got the most unusual entertainment. Along with the music, comedy, and drama, which were regular features, they heard Hedy Lamarr milking a cow. And Miller dancing in G.I. shoes. And Sheridan frying their breakfast eggs.
and the never-to-be-forgotten wedding of Dick Tracy and Tess Truehart, as played by Bing Crosby and Dinah Shore.
Who's that knocking at my door? Who's that singing troubadour? Bringing song to my boudoir.
It is I, Dick Tracy.
How I love your square-cut chin. I'll come down and let you in. Hiya, Dick. Give me some skin.
Thank you, Scad's Tess Trueheart. Well, the big day, huh, Tess? We're finally going to get married.
Yes, Dick, and this time you better go through with it. I've waited 13 years to get married, and you keep putting it off.
Well, honey, some big crime keeps coming up, and I have to dash out and solve it. In 1941, it was 88 keys. In 1942, it was Mrs. Pruneface. And in 1944...
Wait a minute. What happened to 1943?
Very interesting year. My laundry came back. Come, Tess, let us join the merry throng and get on with the nuptials. I will fling open the door.
Oh, happy, 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 happy wedding day.
Oh, shut up. At last, my moment has come. Tess Trueheart, do you take this man to be your lawful wedded husband?
I do.
Richard Tracy, do you take this woman to be your lawful wedded wife?
I do.
Oh, at last. I now pronounce you man and... Oh, bean juice. Blasted interruptions. Always interrupted. I get that dang
excuse
coroner.
Me. Excuse me, darling.
Oh, Richard.
Hello, Tracy at this end.
Hello, police chief on this end. Well, that takes care of both ends.
But let one of the people who was in on all this wartime activity of AFRS tell you about it. Let's transfer our microphones to the San Fernando Valley home of the favorite singer among servicemen everywhere, Miss Dinah Shore.
Thank you, and hi, you fellas. I'm enjoying listening to this program about AFRS. And it brings back a whole lot of memories to me. This microphone was anything but a stranger during those years. I saw those initials AFRS a good many times. And I knew that on the other side of the mic, there was the greatest listening audience a gal could ever ask for. It's a wonderful thing to know that a song you sing or a story you tell and or the few words you speak during a program like this will be heard by millions of people all over the world. No matter how the numbers grew or how the lines expanded, I saw your network growing and expanding, too, through the South Pacific and into the Philippines and from Africa to the European continent. It was a real symbol of victory when there were AFRS stations in Tokyo and in Berlin. But now let's get back to your narrative and pick up the story from there.
With the victorious end of the war, the need for the Armed Forces Radio Service became even greater. Born of a wartime necessity, it became indispensable in time of peace. To the men on occupation duty in foreign lands, to the men who served on ships of our Navy, to the men of our service hospitals that make up the bedside network, AFRS had a continuing mission. Our military planners were aware of this when they established the network that covered the world. Today, AFRS has two distinct jobs. First, to provide transcription programs for release overseas and in hospitals in the States. And second, to maintain a continual broadcast service through powerful shortwave transmitters. 63 hours of programs are recorded each week. The military air transport service flies them around the globe. Some of these programs are written and produced by AFRS personnel. Others are taken directly from the nation's networks, enabling the service audience to hear...
Dragnet. The documented story of an actual crime.
The Red Skelton Show. Fibber McGee and Molly.
Arthur Godfrey and his talent scout.
I am the Whistler.
The University of Chicago Roundtable.
Yes, all these and many more. Music, drama, comedy, discussion programs. Name it and you'll find it in your program schedule. Of course, there's one small difference. You have no commercials. The programs are first recorded on tape, and then the commercials are deleted.
leaving a smooth show with no advertising content. These shows represent millions of dollars invested in time and talent, and it is a tribute to the stars, the sponsors, the advertising agencies, and the networks that they are released overseas without one commercial plug. So in this roundup of personalities who make all this possible, let's by all means include one of their representatives.
I am one of the people who pay the bills. I am a sponsor. I can't tell you my name because it's part of my product. And you won't hear it mentioned on this network. I'm not used to being in front of a microphone. I hire others to do that for me. But I would like to say that all the time and effort, yes, and money too, that we sponsors put into our radio program serve a higher purpose when AFRS sends our shows around the world. They bring a touch of home to our men and women in uniform. As a sponsor and as a representative in the field of commercial broadcasting, I am very proud to be a part of the AFRS family.
The other general classification of programs broadcast through the facilities of the Armed Forces Radio Service is written, produced, and recorded right here in Hollywood. These programs, too, run the gamut from drama to comedy, from 5-minute fillers to 30-minute segments of music. And among the most important are the dramatic and documentary programs, which have earned AFRS the highest awards in radio.
First award presented to AFRS for the Information and Education Program Series Fellowship.
First award for the program series Pride of Service.
First award for the program series This is Russia.
First award for the program series Ambassador of Goodwill.
Special citation from the National Conference of Christians and Jews.
Special citation from the Freedom Foundation.
Yes, and back of these awards is the diligent work of highly trained personnel who understand the problems involved in each project. A script or series of programs may start with a teletype message from Washington, D.C. to Hollywood, California. The basic idea is discussed and expanded by the commanding officer, the chief of operations, the program director. It is turned over to the writer, who does the necessary research and then begins to weave facts together and to get them down on paper in the form of a dramatic script. The words mount as the story is unfolded and the first draft is completed. The script passes through various hands for comment and revision and is finally marked approved for production. Now, the director takes over and begins casting the show.
Hello?
The stars and the supporting players who will bring the words to life, who will give warmth to the cold words of the script and reality to fictional characters. Meanwhile, the talented composers of Hollywood are at work, creating a musical score for the production, matching the words with music, underscoring the dramatic scenes, adding one more important part to the elements that make up a radio program. The sound effects men are busy, too, working out all the sound problems that are indicated in the script, effects which will lend realism to the finished product. Rehearsals begin. The director brings all the elements together. Stars and supporting players become letter perfect in their parts. The orchestra carefully rehearses under the watchful eye of the conductor. The dress rehearsal comes off without a hitch, and then they're ready for the final take. The sign over the control booth says, "Stand by." The actors assemble at the microphone. The conductor raises his baton. The director gives a cue, and the program goes on the air. Thus have come into being the information and education shows, planned, written, and produced by AFRS with one audience in mind, the Armed Forces of the United States. Aside from the dramatic shows that we've already mentioned, they include such musical programs as this.
Well, hi there, fellas and gals. This is Carolina Cotton. With 15 minutes, we've roped and tied. So hold that corral gate open wide while we brand a few musical mavericks for you.
And if the musical tastes of the servicemen are better served in another fashion, there's personal album.
For you.
Well, fellas, there's that theme we love to hear. It's Monica Lewis time. And here comes Monica with personal album packed full of your very own musical favorites. Monica takes a quarter hour off from her duties at the film studios to sing your songs and to visit with you. So let's roll out the welcome mat for the gal with the beautiful blonde hair and those big brown eyes, Monica Lewis.
Thank you, Dale, and hi, everybody. Well, here we go again with more mail and more songs to sing.
Once again, answering the requests of men stationed overseas who send thousands of letters pouring into AFRS headquarters every week, there is the Lena Romay Show.
Una que se quiebra bajo las tinieblas de mi soledad. ¿A dónde vas? Dime si esta noche tú te vas de ronda como ella se fue. ¿Con quién estás?
Or perhaps the men hear their requests answered on other programs, such as Jubilee or Hot Off the Record Press. And for the actual voices of families and friends, they need only tune into the popular Way Back Home program, where they hear the bell in the steeple of the local church on a Sunday morning calling the worshipers to service. The traffic noises on the main street of their own hometown.
Oh, well, hello, Jean. We're just doing fine. It's still dry and hot here. But we're expecting you home in October, and we can hardly wait for the time for you to come.
The personal message from a loved one that is recorded and sent around the earth. Each day brings a new assignment. Each week calls for a new production schedule to fill the many hours of programming. To complete the picture of this portion of AFRS activities, let's switch once again to another studio across town and hear from one of Hollywood's finest dramatic actresses, Miss Claire Trevor.
Thank you, and hello, everybody. It's nice for me to be able to talk to you as myself now, instead of as an actress. I've just finished reading a script that I'll soon be doing for the Armed Forces Radio Service. I hope you enjoy the program when you hear it. I do want to tell you how much all of us in Hollywood realize your need for entertainment and for factual information. After all, that's our business. Creating characters on the radio, in motion pictures, on the stage. Characters that you will remember. From the bit player to the star. From the sound effects man to the recording engineer. We're all in this with but one purpose in mind. To provide you with the best of whatever talent we may have. As Dinah Shore said earlier, you're a great audience.
There is one other very important part to the AFRS story, the shortwave operations, with broadcasts beamed to virtually all points on the surface of the Earth. 12 powerful transmitters located on both coasts of the continental United States send out nightly shortwave broadcasts all night long, every night. In addition to our servicemen and women, these programs are heard by an estimated 90 million persons of all nationalities who recognize our voice as the voice of truth. About 45% of this broadcast time is devoted to straight news. No commentary, no editorializing, just the accurate, undistorted news. Into the shortwave room of AFRS come the reports from all over the world by direct wire from the major news services. Here they are edited and prepared for broadcast, and the actual broadcasting is done by enlisted men of the Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marine.
From AFRTS Los Angeles, here is a summary of the latest world news. Airman First Class Les Osborne reporting. First, here are the highlights.
And among the fraternity of newsmen, as in the entertainment world, there is great respect for the other man's ability. Let one of them tell you what he thinks of the coverage that AFRS gives to the news. Here is Mr. Knox Manning.
I'm standing now in the shortwave room where a battery of teletype machines is pouring out the news on long yellow sheets of paper. It's a scene with which I'm quite familiar, having reported the news myself for something over 20 years. But nowhere here will you see anything that looks like the traditional newsroom. No reporters dashing in with a scoop. No society editor looking for a flowery phrase. It's all business here, and the business is news. The staff, partly military, partly civilian, is conscious of its responsibility to carry the straight news, factual and uncensored. Even during the recent presidential election, AFRS carefully took the middle course, reporting the campaign without bias or prejudice or attempt to influence. In my time as a newsman, I've covered everything from social events to crime waves, from battles in the divorce court to battles between nations. But let me just say this. The shortwave broadcasts of AFRS come the closest to real news reporting that we have today. There's no slanting, no opinions, no editorials, just news.
Probably no other single type of program is more popular than the sports broadcast. Once again, AFRS stands at the top of its field, for this is the largest sports network in the world. All year long, play-by-play broadcasts of all types of sports events are shortwaved overseas. The World Series, the tennis championships, the Olympic Games, the top professional and collegiate football matches. All the major sports events reach our servicemen wherever they are stationed. Yes, all these many things we have talked about make up the Armed Forces Radio Service. It's a big operation involving many people, technicians, writers, performers, directors, executives, military personnel, and civilians. And back of it all is the American public. A public, incidentally, that never gets to hear the broadcasts of this network. For a word about them, we switch you once again to another studio in Hollywood. It may be just a bit noisy because there's a rehearsal in progress there now, starring a man who's landed on more beaches in the movies than most of us have in actual war, and who is also a veteran of 6 years' service in the Army, Mr. Forrest Tucker.
This is Forrest Tucker speaking to you from a rehearsal studio in Hollywood. We're about to record a dramatic show for broadcast to our armed forces overseas. When you talk about the public, the great American public, I'm right into the conversation. During the past year, I've had a chance to meet the public in person. You've probably heard about our project called Movie Time USA. I've traveled more than 30,000 miles around the country, big cities and small towns. I've seen the people who go to movies, listen to the radio, and watch television. I know what a tremendous thing entertainment is, what a big part it plays in our lives. Those people are the ones who are paying the bills. They're the taxpayers. Our men and women in uniform are getting entertainment wherever they may be stationed around the world. When you get right down to it, it's the people of America who are making it possible.
This is a big story that we have covered in a half hour. A story that includes many elements. It's a little 50-watt station on a tiny island in the mid-Pacific. It's a giant 100,000-watt transmitter in Germany. It's a documentary program that reveals the insidious aims of communism to an eavesdropping audience of many nationalities. It's a comedy program that brings a moment of laughter and cheer to a serviceman far from home. It's tubes and wires, turntables, dials, cables, and transmitters. It's the guilds and crafts and unions that cooperate with us. The actors, singers, musicians who perform for us. And above all, it's you, the audience. The sailor at sea, the wounded Marine in a hospital. The listener to one of the 67 AFRS stations around the world. This voice of ours is strong. The signal is loud and clear. Through it, we will continue to promote the highest standards of American democracy within our armed forces. There is no end to the AFRS story.
You've been listening to the AFRS story with Bill Woodson as narrator and featuring Dinah Shore, Claire Trevor, Knox Manning, and Forrest Tucker. Others in the cast were Julie Bennett, Herb Ellis, Bill Foreman, Leo Cleary, Art Ballinger, Clayton Post, and Jack Lloyd. Music was composed by John Hicks with musical direction by Michelle Perrier. The AFRS story was written by Robert C. Vinson, produced and directed by Will Scott. Al Goodwin speaking. This is the United States Armed Forces Radio Service, the voice of information and education.
And my pleasure is to the show you want to hear. For the Army and the Navy and the Air Force too. Here's a lot of entertainment. And it all is meant for you. And bye, here we go. Here's
story of atrocity. Atrocity. An outrageously wicked act. Enormous wickedness. Extreme heinousness or cruelty.
Webster defined atrocity with words. The men of Japan defined it with action.
Today, a new issue of Life magazine reached the newsstand. It featured a story of horror, the story of the thousands of Americans and Filipinos who fell into the hands of the Japanese when Bataan and Corregidor fell, and of 10 who escaped. Tonight, in this exclusive broadcast, the National Broadcasting Company brings its listeners excerpts from that story as it was told to Lieutenant Welburn Kelly, United States Naval Reserve, by 2 of the 10 who escaped from Tojo. Our two storytellers.
Lieutenant Colonel Stephen M. Melnick, United States Army.
Commander Melvin H. McCoy, United States Navy. This is a story of atrocity. As professional military men, one a graduate of Annapolis, the other of West Point, we are fully aware that atrocity stories as such can be dangerous in wartime. Yet for the good of our country, and in the dim hope that it may improve the treatment of our fellow Americans still in Japanese hands, we feel most emphatically that this story should be told, and told now. In telling it, each of us is elected to tell the part with which he is most familiar.
Lieutenant Colonel Melnick.
We took it on Corregidor. For weeks on end, day and night, we took it. And we knew there was no hope. Bataan had fallen a month before. The rock of Corregidor would fall next, and soon. We all knew it, but we couldn't admit it. It was May 6th. Just a few hours more for the Stars and Stripes to wave defiantly above Malinta Tunnel. Though all the events of those hours will remain with me forever, some stand out sharper than others in my mind. A tour of inspection around the rock. Most of our guns smashed, knocked out for good. Enemy 240 shells falling all over the place. A youngster from Iowa spitting on his hands behind his machine gun and saying,
"Nice morning, Colonel. Nice morning."
A routine visit to Malinta Tunnel, headquarters for General Wainwright. The only hospital left for nurses, doctors, and wounded. Hospital beds jumping with enemy salvos, but everything normal. Breakfast being served. A charge nurse meticulously entering records of morphine used in the last 24 hours.
I know this recording is silly, Colonel. It won't matter soon whether the records are here or not. But I've got to believe it does matter. I've got to.
A blonde nurse going by with a tray, singing out with a wink.
We'll have to go out there and do it ourselves.
Dawn of May 6th. Three Jap tanks land on the rock. Bitter realization that our anti-tank guns are of World War I vintage. 9 a.m., Jap snipers everywhere. 10 a.m., orders sent to all artillery units to destroy their guns and ammunition by 12 noon. 12 noon. Silence descends on the rock. Some men crying quietly, others hysterical, but most waiting in stony silence. On the stroke of 12, General Wainwright leaving the tunnel to arrange the surrender. The rest of us waiting, just waiting, with no thought for tomorrow, for there is no tomorrow. For us, the end had come.
Commander McCoy.
At 11:55 on the morning of May 6, 1942, I wrote out the Navy's last message from the rock and handed it to a radioman first class at the sending apparatus.
Yes, sir.
Beam it for Radio Honolulu. Don't bother with code.
Yes, sir. Going off air now. Goodbye. And good luck. Callahan and McCoy. That all, sir?
Yes, that's all.
Lieutenant Colonel Melnick. 2 days after the surrender, they woke us at night, ordered us out of the tunnels on the rock. 7,000 Americans, 5,000 Filipinos.
Stand out!
You lousy brute, you can't make him march. He's got a broken leg.
You understand now? Everybody matters. Including the wounded.
Yes, everyone marched. Even those with broken bones and serious injuries. They herded us onto the small concrete strip at Kindley Field. All 12,000 of us jammed together like cattle in a pen. We stayed there for 7 days. There was only one water spigot for the 12,000. A 12-hour wait to fill one canteen was the usual rule. The heat was at its worst. Men fainted by the score. We were covered by clouds of black flies, and dysentery had already begun to spread among us. Our dead, their bodies bloating, lay on the rock for several days. After 7 days, they gave us our first meal. One mess kit of rice and a tin of sardines. Then they loaded us aboard 3 small steamers. 4,000 in a boat designed to accommodate 12 passengers. They took us to within 100 yards of the mainland shore and made us jump overboard. On shore, we were lined up 4 abreast, presenting as a group the worst possible appearance. Wet, bedraggled, hungry, thirsty, and many so weak from wounds and illness they could hardly stand.
Now, we march through Manila, yes? The Filipinos now see powerful white man as he really is.
Commander McCoy.
The Japanese had intended this to be a triumphal victory parade. But there were few signs of happiness on the faces of the Filipinos who lined our route. Instead, there were many tears and many carefully shielded signs of encouragement. All during the march, the heat was terrific. It has been my observation that the Japanese deliberately wait for the hottest part of the day before moving American prisoners. The weaker ones in our ranks began to stumble during the first mile. Bayonet thrust made them get back into line and march until they dropped. More bayonet points then forced them to their feet again to stagger onward. But some had reached the point where even an inch of bayonet brought no response. We didn't know then how lucky those men were. We didn't know then that we had been marked for transfer to the prison camp at Cabanatuan. We didn't know then that at Cabanatuan, death is part of the way of life. Death. And things worse than death.
Lieutenant Colonel Melnick.
What is it, Jones? What's happened?
I'm not positive, Colonel Melnick, but I think some guys escaped. Tojo's little muscle men are running around like chickens with their heads cut off.
Someone's escaped?
Yeah. 3 young ensigns, I understand.
Well, they've got their nerve. Don't they know it's against the rules to escape from Cabanatuan?
Yes, we started life at Cabanatuan with some pleasant excitement and a great hope born of 3 young ensigns' success. McCoy had not yet arrived at the notorious prison camp when this happened. By the time he joined us, our temporary hope was as dead as Molly's ghost. We barely settled into the prison at Cabanatuan when on June 2nd, the first detachment of prisoners from Bataan began to arrive at our camp. They arrived in trucks for the simple reason that only very few of them were physically able to stand up and walk even 100 yards. Bad off as we were ourselves, we were appalled at their condition, and even more appalled when we learned what had happened to them on what they all called the death march from Bataan. In the first truck to arrive was a young enlisted man who at one time had served as my orderly. He staggered to my side and, holding himself up by feebly grasping at my shoulders, he sobbed out,
"Is it different here? Will they treat us like humans?"
"Take it easy, son. Take it easy.
I can't stand anymore, Colonel. Sir,
I just can't stand anymore.
It'll be all right, Fisher. Don't worry. Don't worry.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
He staggered away, still sobbing. The Bataan prisoners had been in the hands of the Japs a month longer than we had. They were the most woebegone objects I've ever seen. They were wild-eyed, gaunt, their clothes in tatters. Many had no equipment of any kind, and some clutched at rusty tin cans which they used as mess kits. They had their own doctors, the medical attachments in Bataan, but the doctors had no medicine. They were as sick as the men. Still tried to do what they could, though. The first Bataan contingent arrived on a certain day, and one of the doctors called to me.
Colonel Malnick.
Yes, Major?
Colonel, you're a group leader. You've got to get one of the Japanese doctors to look at this man.
What's the trouble with him?
He's in the last stages of what is most commonly known as wet beriberi.
The sick man was a young quartermaster lieutenant. He was horribly swollen from the hips down, in frightful pain.
Please. Medicine.
Now, forget it, son. You'll be all right.
No, I won't, Doctor. I don't mind the pain. I can stand the pain. But the swelling. If swelling goes above my hips to my heart, I'll die. That's true, isn't it, Doctor? That's true, isn't it? Answer me.
We finally got a Japanese doctor to examine the kid. But the man might just as well have been made of rock. He stood there, looking down at the suffering boy, gently hissing. His face impassive, untouched by the slightest pity or emotion.
Doctor, please, some medicine. Give it to me. I'll take care of it. I don't ask you to use your time. All I ask is medicine.
Yes.
It hurts, Major. It hurts. I don't mind the pain. It's the swelling. Don't let it kill me, sir. Don't let it kill me.
Look, Captain. You and I, we're both Army officers. We're enemies. But both of us are doctors, too. We took the Hippocratic Oath. It's our job, our sacred duty to save human life.
Yes?
This boy is your enemy, yes. But he's suffering, dying. The proper medicine can save him. Can you let him die?
Yes. If his condition is not improved in a day or two, I will return with medicine. Yes.
The next day, the boy was dead. But in death, he was not alone. For soon the first chore of every day was the removal from our barracks of the men who died during the night.
Commander McCoy.
Melnick had been at Cabana Tuan about a month when I arrived there. The prisoner's grapevine had given me an inkling of what Cabana Tuan was like. One look at Melnick's face confirmed my fears. This was not a place to stay in long. As soon as we had achieved the greatest degree of privacy one can manage in an open compound containing thousands of weak, weary, dispirited prisoners and a goodly number of sharp-eyed Japanese guards, I mentioned the thing closest to my heart.
Commander McCoy.
Melnick had been at Cabana Tuan about a month when I arrived there. The prisoner's grapevine had given me an inkling of what Cabana Tuan was like. One look at Melnick's face confirmed my fears. This was not a place to stay in long. As soon as we had achieved the greatest degree of privacy one can manage in an open compound containing thousands of weak, weary, dispirited prisoners and a goodly number of sharp-eyed Japanese guards, I mentioned the thing closest to my heart. Steve, have we a chance of escaping?
Escaping? Maybe, Mac, I don't know. Can be done, I suppose.
What's the matter, man?
Nothing. I'm just... Look! Come on!
Against the wall, Americans! Stand at the wall!
According to the laws of this camp, this sentence is carried out. Two of your squad of 10 have escaped. The other 8 must die. Do you wish to be blindfolded, or do you have the courage to face the firing squad?
You got no right to do this to us!
Quiet!
I won't! I tell you, those 2 men didn't escape. They were too sick, that's right.
Quiet! Yowie! Hapo! Yowie! Stop it! Stop it! How dare you interrupt that action of the Imperial Japanese Army?
We found them. The 2 men you said escaped. They were so weak they fell into a latrine ditch.
Where are they? Bring them here at once.
I can't. They're dead.
Lieutenant Colonel Melnick.
I'll never forget a little vignette that met my eyes every day at Cabana Tuan, and again at another camp to which McCoy and I were later transferred, the one at Davao. Picture a man walking around a compound enclosed in barbed wire. He massages his fingers constantly as he walks, stops now and then to massage his toes. A Jap guard follows him with his eyes, a smile on his face. The man is suffering from beriberi, maybe scurvy as well. The pain in his joints, his extremities, is excruciating. Medicine's what he needs, but a balanced diet would help enormously. Fresh fruits and greenstuffs would do the trick. And out there in front of his eyes, greenstuffs and berries grow in abundance, but the barbed wire stands between. And the Jap guard stands and fondles his Tommy gun. The smile set thinly on his face. The Jap guards don't need those berries and greenstuffs. But the prisoner can't have them. You look at the poor devil's eyes as he passes you. You notice again the smile of the Jap guard. And you reflect that certain parts of the Orient have developed rare refinements of cruelty.
Not long after my arrival at Cabana Tuan, I walked one evening in the compound with Melnick. Poor wretches squatted everywhere within my sight, their starved bodies slumped over. Suddenly I saw a familiar face. Say, Steve, isn't that gun over there? The chap sitting in that small group by the fence?
Yeah, that's gun.
Well, how long's he been here?
I got here a few days before you did.
He did? But why didn't you tell me he was here? You know we're friends.
Yes, I know. You were so weak yourself when you arrived. I thought you ought to rest up a bit before meeting him.
No wonder Steve Melnick didn't want me to see Gunn till I felt up to it. I looked at Gunn, fascinated. I could only stammer, You look awful.
Why not? I was on Bataan. I made the death march.
I was afraid to ask him about it. I sat down. Steve sat down. I tried to collect my thoughts and stared straight ahead towards one of the barracks.
Good God.
Huh?
Oh, that. Oh, you'll get used to that.
I had already become aware of the awful stench about the camp. But for the first time, I noticed that outside of each barracks there was a neat row of bodies. Somehow I knew the bodies had been there for some time. Clouds of flies arose from them when groups of prisoners walked nearby.
Yeah, Mac, you'll get used to that.
But why don't they bury them?
They? You mean the Japs?
Well, then why don't you bury them?
Gosh, Mac, you must have had a soft time of it till now. You don't know the Japs. They should bury them. They should let us bury them before the site has seared and desecrated our souls. I tell you, you don't know the Japs, man. Now, before we came here, we spent some time at another hellhole, Camp O'Donnell. At least 2,200 men died there in 2 months that I know of. The Japs wouldn't bury them. And the Americans and Filipinos were so weak, There weren't enough healthy men to dig the graves. As a result, the camp became so littered with bodies that you could hardly tell the living from the dead. And with all of that, all the running water around the camp became polluted, which in turn made more sick and more dead.
Good God.
Oh, sure, you can gasp. But there are thousands of American witnesses to the truth of what I'm telling you. We decided to stand on our rights as prisoners of war. We insisted on seeing the camp commander and complaining to him. I can hear the little bullfinch now sticking out his mangy little chest and shouting,
I tell you this to your face, mine! I do not rest, American! And I do not care how many die, nor how they die!
No, Mac, you don't know the Japs. You don't know them. That dirty, stinking little... But I know them. These fellas here with me, they know them. We made the death march from Bataan.
And then Gunn told us about that death march.
Fell on April the 8th, Mac. The Japs took 10,000 Americans and 45,000 Filipinos prisoners. They marched us to San Fernando, Pampanga, a distance of 120 miles. We were marched in different groups. We often passed running streams, but the Japs seldom allowed us to drink. A few prisoners tried it, mostly Filipinos. They were shot down in cold blood. The Japs didn't mind when we drank from muddy Carabao wallows, though. Ah, they liked to see us do that. That's where we all got dysentery, I suppose. At the end of every day, the Japs dispatched those of us who looked too weak to make the march the following day. But they committed murder with a new twist. They made the condemned dig their own graves. And brother, no matter how sick or wounded or near to dying you are, when a Jap with a sharp bayonet tells you to dig your own grave, you dig, and how you dig. A Jap with...
Shut up, God, shut up. I can't stand it.
It was one of the kids who had made the death march with Gunn. Gunn passed it off casually, but without smiling. Gunn will never smile again.
Johnny doesn't like to think about it, gentlemen. But I can assure you on eyewitness testimony that a Jap with a helpless man in one hand and a bayonet in the other is a supreme artist. Just as if you didn't know.
I'll kill him. I'll kill every last one of them. The dirty, slimy sons.
Sit down, grab him.
Quiet, Johnny. Quiet, quiet. Do you want him to hear you? Oh, now, come on. Try to forget it, son. Try to forget it.
I can't forget it, Commander. I can't.
Shh, boy. Then get it out of your system. Talk about it.
It happened a lot of times. But the first time it happened, I didn't know what was up. A prisoner keeled over. He'd been stumbling for hours. The Japs dragged him out of the line to a ditch by the side of the road. Then they took me out of line. They took me to where the poor guy was lying in the ditch. One of the Japs handed me a shovel. Another jabbed the bayonet at me and shouted an order in Japanese. I didn't know what they wanted. Then a Jap grabbed the shovel out of my hand and showed me. He threw a few shovels full of earth on the unconscious soldier. Then he handed me the shovel. Dear God, it doesn't help to tell myself that he was more dead than alive. The worst time was once when a poor guy with 6 inches of dirt over him suddenly regained consciousness and tried to sit up.
He clawed away at the dirt, trying to save himself. Then the Jap bayonet stuck me in the back.
There are some stories which it is better not to finish.
You're right, Mac. There are stories which it's better not to finish. At least, well, at least not through a medium which is welcomed into the homes of a people raised in the principles of Christian charity.
But don't think, Americans, that such stories as you've just heard are the outstanding examples of Japanese atrociousness. As a matter of fact, they are the least shocking of the hundreds we have caused to be printed or could tell.
Think of the doings of the Nazis in the ghettos of Poland. Cast your mind back to the unholy times when tyrants impaled the heads of those who displeased them on the gateposts of their castles. Dwell on the gentler arts and forms once practiced in the Inquisition torture chambers. Imagine the starvation of Athens, the filth, hopelessness of Devil's Island. Add them all up, and you'll have a good picture of the Japanese treatment of American military prisoners in the Philippines. We know.
You have heard an exclusive NBC radio adaptation of excerpts of the story, Ten Who Escaped from Tojo, which was published in today's issue of Life magazine. The story in Life was written by Lieutenant Welburn Kelly, United States Naval Reserve, as it was told to him by Commander Melvin H. McCoy, United States Navy, and Lieutenant Colonel Stephen M. Melnick, United States Army. Radio script of Prisoners of Japan was prepared by Richard McDonough and featured Kenneth Daniel and Martin Gable in the roles of Commander McCoy and Lieutenant Colonel Melnick. Harold Huber was heard as Gunn. The original music was composed and conducted by Morris Momorsky. The entire production was under the direction of Anton M. Leder. This is the National Broadcasting Company.